You are listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource, and we are grateful to all of our listeners who help keep us the podcast going by donating to the show. We are also grateful and proud to be supported by the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies.
Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 65, where Pedro, Greta, and Tom are discussing the work and legacy of the Aston School with our special guest, Bob Heinings. If you missed part one, you can access it on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So in the first part of our conversation, we talked about the making of the Aston studies and also discussed a bit the influence it has had and also the influence that it has not had, you know, what things were taken up or not. And towards the end, we discussed how much our field has changed and how much the concepts that were used have taken a different meaning. You know, and even we have discussions today on the extent that ideas from bureaucratic organizations are still relevant, with some people believing that, you know, this is all passé and we should be studying different things and so on. Bob also told us about the way the field has changed and this attention to comparative work has become less central. And I wanted to reflect a bit on that as we go into this part. Because I think that one of the things that we can learn from the Aston studies is how, I mean, first of all, we already talked about that things like organizational structure or bureaucracy are much more complex and rich when we look them up close. And I think that's one of the important insights that this body of research has given us. But it also, I think there is something relevant in terms of the way in which we have, as a field, an attention towards things that are new necessarily, in terms that comparisons are important not only individually in every single study, but also as a collective body of knowledge in which we try to build upon each other. And my impression is that, you know, as other things became fashionable in organizational theory, and we try to abstract things at a more high level, we forgot the importance of trying to understand how the insights we have apply to different contexts and how can relate to other situations. And there's another thing, and I think that's is interesting in a way, is that, you know, and we were talking about this in the break, is Birmingham was very much a manufacturing complex back then. And this kind of sector of the economy has almost been outsourced, but doesn't mean doesn't exist somewhere still. You know, it's just other things have become more fashionable, and then people become interested in study them with new tools and new ways, and forgot, I think, a bit of the importance of trying to relate back and trying to build something common.
I completely agree with you, Pedro, and that kind of brings me to some of the ideas that I started to develop as I was reading the papers about kind of when we look at organizations today, and my research focuses on technology companies and the platforms they develop and how they're adopted by firms. And a lot of the insights in these studies are still relevant. I still see it. And kind of, you know, like we had the episode on Joan Woodward before, and where Joan Woodward kind of made like this key argument that, you know, the structure of the organization is not the same. It depends on what type of technologies are being used. And now, yeah, what you pointed out, Bob, is indeed that was also true for the Aston studies, but it's mostly known also for the size. And when you look now at the technologies that firms use, and compare that to the technologies that were used at the time when you collected the data. I'd love to hear your reflections on, you know, how they changed and how that relates to size and kind of the structures that we see nowadays.
Okay, I mean, if I can take that and also what Pedro says, I in the break, there's a book that I go to quite often these days. It's a research in the, you probably all know it, it's a research in the Sociology of Organizations volume, number 26, actually, edited by Braden King, Teppo Felling, and Dave Wetton, called Studying Differences Between Organizations, Comparative Approaches to Organizational Research. And in the introduction, there's one section called Comparative Organizational Analysis and Its Demise, and then an examination of why it has, and then trying to argue that we need to go back to that. I think that relates to what you were, what Pedro was saying, and also what Greta, you're saying. That is that, yes, we have different kinds of organizations in the societies in which we tend to be located and do our research. Yes, there are still automobile manufacturers. Yes, there are still organizations that make engine blocks or whatever, but they're kind of few and far between. And so, I mean, I, in my own work with Royston Green, went and started looking at large-scale professional service firms, accounting firms, law firms, etc. Now, when you move, and you know this very well, of course, from looking at platform-based organizations, the technology changes, but, I mean, they are technology-based organizations. And a couple of things strike me. One is kind of conceptual, that I think we don't see the word technology or the concept technology used a great deal directly. We actually now tend to talk about materiality and affordances, you know, which come close actually to some of the things we used to talk about with technology. I think when we look at those organizations, I mean, obviously the Googles, the Microsofts, the Amazons, you know, these are very, very large organizations, not as large as the big manufacturing organizations used to be. And they organize in different ways. So we talk about the gig economy, and we talk about all the, you know, the workers who are not, where the organizations themselves say, well, no, they're not employees. So there's still the question of how are they organized and how is this related, first of all, to the technological basis of their work and the scale that they moved into. I mean, they're still very large organizations. They're technologically based organizations, but they're organizing in a different way. So we may want to look at, say, the Aston type studies and say, well, what is in there that helps us understand it? Or what is in, I mean, I think there's a lot in Joan Woodrell's ideas in the way in which she, James Thompson, where you're talking about long link technologies and so on, you know, talking about the linkages between tasks, between the units of the organization and so on, how the service gets put together. That for me would be important. So having said that, I'm not sure whether I've really answered anything that Pedro or Greta raised, but those are some first thoughts anyway.
Thanks, Bob. Like, one of the things I'm thinking of is, you know, with these gig economy platforms or online labor platforms, you know, when you think about organizational size, it becomes very messy. Like, who is a member of the organization and who is just a contractor hired in the marketplace? Kind of this, where do you set the boundaries of the firm? And what you see now is, for instance, the number of firms have a revenue for over $1 million and only having one employee has drastically increased. I forgot the name of the author, but I will send it to you, who wrote a book about this, like this phenomenon of one-person companies becoming millionaires. And you know, when you think of how do we then look at size, how do we look at structure, what is it actually that we need to look at in order to understand what type of organization this is? And I thought your work on the dimensions gives a very good framework for looking at it.
I mean, a couple of things on that. One is that historically, organization theory has never looked systematically and satisfactorily at small organizations. I think it's a really big gap in the whole construction of that area. I mean, it's been carved off almost as a separate area called entrepreneurship. And so that there's a group of different people who look at entrepreneurs and are not interested in organizational issues. And then there are organization theorists who, I know, look at organizations that think of a number, employ at least 50 people and maybe more. I mean, go back to the Aristotelians. Our bottom category was 250 organizations, 250 employees. Well, 250 is a very large number when you look at organizations as a whole. So I think we've historically not done a very good job on analyzing, describing the way in which smaller organizations are structured. And I think that's where, when we look at taxonomies, typologies, the non-bureaucratic ones, I mean, the notion, I mean, think of Henry Mintzberg and his notion of simple structures and so on. You know, again, there are the ideas there, there are the potential tools there. And I suppose because of my origins in the Aston studies and in classical sociology, I do sort of start from saying, oh, well, if I'm going to look at, bookings.com, my first question in my mind is, how are they organized to provide this service? Let me get to grips with what the service is, what its component parts are, how they are put together, regardless initially of whether the people putting them together are employees or not. Now, whether employees or not, then may well become a very important distinction in understanding how they do what they do. But leads us beyond talking about size or thinking about size in a different way. So, you know, I can't get away from walking into the supermarket and thinking, now, how are they organized? Who does what? And how do they relate to the other people in the organization? It's just embedded in me so strongly.
Yeah, I have a somewhat related question, especially going back to the fascination we have with new organizations, because one of the things I wonder about is the degree to which the organizations that you looked at the 1960s were formed and very stable in their operations. Because I know that, for quite some time, Google has been put forth as somewhat of a model of what other organizations should be gravitating towards. The things that were very innovative about the organization, with the time set aside to explore new experiments and all of these things that were fresh, new, interesting. But when we really look about it, we think, what is the formative period of an organization, and to what extent has it actually, stabilized in terms of its operations? Because the Google closer at the beginning of its organization is very different from the Google of today, will probably be different from the Google of 5 years from now. Substitute any of those other firms that you mentioned. And sometimes I think we gloss over to the fact that when we're talking about new organizations, sometimes they do tend to attract a lot of attention, not just because they're new, but when they create an innovation that is interesting. What we tend to forget is that, maybe some of these innovations ultimately show some vulnerabilities. We don't think about the downsides as much. And some of the downsides of these new firms, the vulnerabilities of the way in which they were trying to do things differently, only start to appear like maybe 5-10 years later, when we stop looking at them because they're not new anymore. So I'm wondering, you know, the timing and the relationship with the stability of the firm, how that plays out, how we should be looking at that more or less.
That's a kind of wonderful set of points, and I could make a couple of observations. Again, when I started working with Royston Greenwood in 1973, we were studying organizational change. We were studying a massive change in the British local government system, where the government itself reorganized the whole system and said and gave advice on how different kinds of organizations should be organized, with at the center the idea of introducing a very new thing for those organizations: strategic and corporate planning. You know, going back, so this is early 70s, saying we've got too many silos, we need to bring them together, we need to find ways. Now, we initially started to think about them in terms of the Asner study of dimensions, but actually over time we developed some different dimensions. Now, again, to look at that, to look at the kind of thing that you're talking about, and we had five people working full time for 5 years, and then two of us going on, and we eventually ended up, well, initially we ended up with very detailed, back to Greta's point about mixed methods, very detailed information about 26 organizations that were systematically sampled and tracking their change, their organizational changes, and we eventually were able to extend that to a 10-year study. So we looked at these organizations, and most of them were unable to change all the way. And so we came up with what we call four different tracks. I think it was four of change, you know. So yes, we used the notion of changing organizational forms to do that. And I think that's exactly the point when you look at a Google audit. And that leads to my second point, which relates to the new organizations. You may or may not know that in 2018, I published a paper in a journal called Information and Organization with a guy called Thomas Gegenhuber and can't remember his name, Royston Greenwood, that's right. And it was a piece that talked about how institutional theory could be applied to understanding digital innovation. Now, as Thomas, who is a platforms guy, do you know him, Greta?
Yes, I think I met him at the Academy.
Yeah. And you probably do as well, Pedro, I don't know. So anyway, Thomas, who is a platforms guy, you know, he's all of his research work has been about these new platform organizations. And I was arguing that there are at least three different kinds of organizations that we need to look at in terms of digital innovation and transformation. Clearly, there are the new organizations, and everybody, just like me, mentions Airbnb and you know, Spotify and all of those kinds of things. Of course, they're important. But I say, and you mentioned Google, I say there's Microsoft and Google and Amazon. They're not new organizations anymore. I mean, how long has Microsoft been around? 30 years, at least, probably longer, I don't know. But, you know, these are different in the way that they handle things. So what happens when an Apple has Facebook and then he takes over Instagram? And how does it work that together, given that it's got this long, long history as an organization? Then thirdly, and this is where my old history comes in, the ones that I find really, really interesting are the healthcare systems and the banks, you know, the organizations that are still there that go on in some way providing the service that they provided for 40, 50, 60, 100 years, not necessarily in the same way, but are subject to digital innovation and have this history of being an organization. So I think one of the things that we need, again, I come back, of course, to the comparative thing that we need to do as organization theorists is, you know, study these comparatively. However, we have an institutional problem of the journals, which say you've got to be novel. And they have quite a strange sometimes definition of what novelty means. And so it's, and you know, if you're, I'm showing my age here, if you're younger and you're, you know, I mean, all my grandchildren in their 20s and early 30s, you know, and they're into the new organization. So that's what they're interested in. That's what they would start as a studying point. But there's so much more richness out there in the world that we lose when we go for novelty all the time.
Can I just jump in on that? Because another study that I usually find that in a way takes on the Aston tradition, but in a different way, is the one from the Stanford Emerging Companies, which has a study about the process of bureaucratization in Silicon Valley type startups. And interestingly, of course, and that goes back to what Tom was saying, is that in time, they try to understand the different models in which entrepreneurs build organizations. And of course, the bureaucratic is one, but there are also others. But they also find that in time, the companies tend to bureaucratize, especially when they go from just being, you know, a small startup with some people and need to get go into the stock market and so on and so forth. You know, they become more like traditional companies. So there's also, I think, this dimension of not only wanting to study so much the new, but wanting to study the present of this new, not realizing that these things have a trajectory. And I think that the point that you mentioned is very interesting on how we have outsourced this study of this type of organizations, also people like entrepreneurship, and how much there are opportunities for research, you know. And I think that it's important to say that it's not that we already know everything. It's the opposite. It's that we can use what we know already to try to illuminate and ask questions about what is happening. What I think, however, is, again, it might be just my negative reading, is that surprisingly, not everyone in organizational research is interested in organizational phenomena, or it is in the way we would think about that in the Aston study. As you were saying, you know, how the organization is an important denominator in the way we ask the questions, trying to understand that the way it's organized may matter for the question that we have, and maybe it doesn't, but it's important to pose the question. You know, I feel that we already, some of the people who start this study, just taking just as a pure context the organization or the inter-organization, whatever it is. But I think this was more of a rant than a question or anything. So maybe someone has a point.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking about with that is when we talk about some of the new firms who establish a stake that say that we're going to be different, we're innovative, we're new, we're fresh, we're whatever. And then as they bureaucratize, do they actually acknowledge it, or do they try to maintain their formative identities as a way of sort of like denying that they're turning into everybody else? That's a question. I don't know if that's... Because I get that sense in some cases, mm-hmm. that they hold on to these formative stories a little bit long.
Yes.
And they're obscuring and essentially denying what they're actually becoming, because they fear it makes them sound like what they tried to get away from in the first place.
So I have an anecdote on that. I studied a plane manufacturer for my PhD, and that plane manufacturer is now doing some work with people in Silicon Valley type of situations to, you know, think of, you know, different kinds of, I don't even to classify this kind of different types of planes, electric and some that lift up vertically, not horizontally, you know, all these kind of super shrunky innovations. So they are a very established traditional, and they are, of course, a regulated industry. So they have a lot of procedures. And they are now collaborating with these Silicon Valley people. So I spoke with one of the engineers that are, you know, in this joint venture type of situation, and he said an interesting reflection. He said, the product is shiny and the ambience is very cool and different, but the engineering work is very much I would see, you know, as here or any other place, you know. So I think there's also this, and again, and I think the idea of dimensions is interesting here, you know. The work of Austin is very much about structure, but you can think also in different dimensions, which is exactly the ambience of work. Google is different at that dimension, so to speak, but I am sure that the way the work is structured, the technical engineering work, has a lot of the traditional things we associated with, you know, procedures, standardizations, records, whatever.
I think it was your first point that kind of, I think, resonated with me, Pedro. That is, I think one of the things that has also disappeared from organizational studies, as you said, is a concern with the organization per se. And that's particularly true of what has become, you know, the dominant, maybe too strong, but the, you know, one of the most important theorizing areas, which I've been associated with, institutional theory. And again, Royston and Dave Wetton and I wrote a piece for the Journal of Management Studies Point Counterpoint debate, which was essentially starting point was, why has the organization disappeared from institutional theory, when of course where it started with Mayer and Rowan was to introduce another set of ideas about why organizations are as they are. So now institutional theorists will spend time talking about all sorts of things except the organization. And you know, that's important, but I think, again, as you were saying, we need to think again about where is the organization in all of this.
I couldn't agree more with you, Bob. Very important points being made here. And it kind of makes me think about, you know, the team that got together. And you mentioned, like, you all had very different background. And you worked together for a period of 5 years. You mentioned you only had to teach one course a year, so there was a substantive time to work together. And can you tell a bit about, you know, how it was to work together across these disciplinary boundaries, having a different training, so to say? And maybe also looking at, you know, how did that shape? How did studies evolved? How has it the richness of such a multidisciplinary team?
Yeah, I think one of the things, Greta, is that, yes, we were multidisciplinary, but we quickly came to an agreement about what it was we were studying, the organization and its form. And that was, and the, I suppose, initially, people like David Hickson, could be kept on board. He actually initially really wanted to get out there in the field and study what people did in these organizations, because that's what his master's had been all about. But we spent the first year pretty well getting to understand what it was we wanted to study, and spending a lot of time doing kind of preliminary forays into the field to just get more familiar with the settings that we would be studying. And I think that programmatic focus, which we never ever managed to carry out, of yes, we're studying the organization in order to be able to study the internal workings of an organization in terms of organizational differences, and then we could look at individuals, kept somebody like David Hickson on side. And actually, over time, he changed entirely what it was he was interested in. And for Derek, it was always that programmatic thing. And Derek is one of those figures. Now, how can I say this? Incredibly, incredibly bright man. Maybe the brightest person I've ever known, with his insights and his knowledge. But he actually found doing research and writing quite difficult. And so he did it. but he always used to tell the story that he got an upper second class honours degree at Edinburgh in experimental psychology. And the examiner said to him, "If only you'd written more, we could have given you a first." Because it's difficult. So he was this man who had tremendous insights and the idea of the program. And so that was always what pushed him. And I think it's fair to say that that was incredibly formative to me. So that when Royston and I, Greenwood and I started work together, we did a 10-year study on the same kind of basis. When we moved independently initially to Alberta, we started off, we were going to do a large-scale study of change. We eventually switched into professional service firms, but we spent the next, 15 years studying professional service firms. So I think that whole programmatic element has always been part of me, and that's what kept the team together and focused with, I suppose, the promise that at a certain point in the future, your particular interests would be fully taken account of. But the process itself actually changed most of our minds about what it was, why we were studying what we were studying.
And interestingly, is one of the core insights of organizational theory itself, how the goal matters for, you know, cooperating and organizing.
It's very insightful, yeah. Bob.
But we never talk these days about organizational purpose.
True. So one thing that I wanted to elaborate, because we talked about, you know, the behind the scenes and how our field has changed and what are the promises that exist, the opportunities that exist looking back at the Aston program. And one thing that I think is very clear when you read the papers is that it has programmatically, and you were hitting at that just now, not look at the activity. You know, it was very much about what is the design, what is the expected outcome, you know, what are the procedures that exist, what are documents that are out there, and are they filled, but it's not so much how they're used or ignored and so on and so forth. And I understand why it was done that, because the goal in the study was very much to go a bit away from the more case study or the inner workings of the group and put that in the context and also try to identify the different factors that could matter for specific behavior patterns. But one thing that I think that happened, unfortunately, is that the discussion on organizational structure has become more and more as, you know, abstracted, based on modeling and not so much fieldwork based. Of course, I still exist people that do fieldwork on org structure, but not so, it's not necessarily the core of that conversation. And on the other hand, we have the people that do the ethnographies, you know, go into the field and see how people do things. And it is a very personal reflection, because I always found myself a bit between these two voices, because I am interested in formal organization, but I'm also interested in going to the field and seeing how people relate to the procedures. How do they talk about that? What do they ignore? How do they reconstruct formalizations on the go? You know, so how these organized get negotiated, done, and many times actually creatively reformed. But it seems that this was, it almost became like a dichotomy in research. You know, so I wonder if you, in your own reading of all these, both sides of the conversation, you have reflected on ways in which, you know, this, the treasure trove, which is the essence, can be connected to these conversations.
No, in a sense, I haven't reflected on that, but let me try a couple of things. I go back, I think, to, I'm sounding like a broken record now, that we need to, anything we do, we need to take seriously the nature of the organization in which whatever we're doing is located. So that if we're studying, I'll go back to institutional logics, we're studying that through a single case, we have to be aware that This is in a particular organization, and to take up something Tom said, at a particular point in its history, at a particular point in time, as it faces particular kinds of issues. So that now that comes out, would come out in, I was actually just reviewing a paper for a colleague at Calgary, and they have this kind of bit at the end of sort of limitations, which often turn out to be, well, the limitation of this study is because it's in a healthcare organization. However, here's how we think it might be generalizable. I think one of the things we need to do in our thinking, and paper that Royston Greenwood and I published in 1996, which is our most cited ever paper, is the institutional theory paper in AMR. And what we did at the end of that paper, having elaborated the theory, we made suggestions as to how this might actually work in different kinds of settings. So I think when we do a study that is in a healthcare organization, say, I don't think we should be talking about what the limitations are. I think we should be utilizing what we found and saying, okay, this makes sense in this kind of organization. However, if we think of another set of organizations which are kind of like healthcare organizations but not the same, here's how we think it might work out. In other words, at the end of our, and what should be central to our thinking is, how would this play out in a different setting? And it seems to me that we don't do that very often. That is where, if you're doing, it seems to me when you're doing case study research, and as you probably know, I mean, most of my research over the last, well, I haven't done much in any empirical research for the last 10 years at least, but before that was kind of case study kind of research. But we need to say, okay, this is a case study of these kinds of organizations in this kind of setting. How would we be able to take what we found and adjust it for other settings, i.e. we produce some hypotheses or propositions or whatever. So that's one way of thinking comparatively through case studies. And I think that's the would be the way to go forward, one way to go forward. I don't see much of that in the case study approach. The other is, of course, I'd like to see more systematic comparative organizations, that people start off by saying, I'm going to study this phenomenon. I'm going to study it. I mean, even if we think about case studies, I'm going to study it in these five organizations, and here's why I am choosing them. I'm really clear about why I'm choosing them and why I will get more out of the study, because I've got this kind of case and this kind of case and this kind of case. And for me, you know, the nature of the organization, how it's organized, would always be an important part of that.
One of the things that comes to my mind as you were talking, and when Pedro raised this issue of the dichotomy, is, are we simply bringing in researchers who are predisposed to wanting, for those who would want to pursue big questions about how organizations behave and would gravitate towards the ethnographic methods, that they are predisposed to want to get at the human experience, and for them, anything discussing structure might appear to be a bit dry or something of that regard. Conversely, perhaps because those who are interested with structure would think that they would want to get into or pursue questions that are a bit shorter term and can perhaps be turned around. Is there somewhat of a link there, perhaps relating to what kind of people we're bringing into the field?
Well, I think we tend to get trained in particular ways, and there is still a division, I think, between North America and Europe, where in most North American PhD programs, then there's a heavy emphasis on large samples and very advanced statistical methods. And yet, interestingly, most of the best papers from ANJ and ASQ tend to be case studies, the ones that get the awards. I think that, so there are different kinds of trainings. I was, I suppose, again, partly because of the ASTA studies, and as Greta said about me, I was trained to be both quantitative and qualitative. I've never seen that or wanted to see that as a kind of ontological or epistemological divide, which is the way it's seen by some people, at least. So I think there are those differences. There is the belief that, for example, in North American journals in particular, you know, you have to have a quantitative approach. I mean, in our program at the U of A, we have a lot of students who come out with very qualitative case study based research. But I say to them, well, you have to know why you choose that case. You have to know something about how the way it does things, the way the things you're interested in are related in some way to the way that organization is formed and structured. And I've remembered what it was. I mean, this is where going back to those classic monographs, again, of Selznick, Blau, and Gouldner, were saying, yeah, I want to look at behavior. I want to look at actual activities that people carry out. But I want to look at them in relation to how the organization is supposed to operate and see how people utilize that, manipulate that, find different ways of coping with that, because they are put into this system, this organization, which actually says, here's what you're supposed to do. And we all know from our own experience in our organizations that we find ways of getting around what we're supposed to do or ignoring what we're supposed to do. That's a very important element. We also know that we get things done by doing what we're supposed to and then adding to it, because that helps things. So how those activities are related to the formality of the organization seems to me a really, really important thing to look at.
Yeah, I had a comment related to what both Tom and Bob just said, because I don't know necessarily that has to do with the personality like of the person, but I think it's exactly the conversation has become a tradition and people get socialized in a specific conversation, and not everyone goes back to read the classics, although they should. So they don't realize where things come from. So they think that their little corner exists independently of the broader, you know, larger conversations, the streams of the conversation, so to speak. And I think there is something about the, you know, the ideographic, ethnographic type research in which it's easier to see the people, because when you interview people, when you follow people, people always explain things through their individual lenses. You know, people talk about themselves and their motivations and what they feel and what they're doing. So that becomes more tangible. So there is something of an analytical vocabulary, but also set of sensitivities that you need to bring to go beyond just what someone is telling me in an interview or what I'm observing in a meeting to understand the overall organization. That takes time, because you have to study not just what you're observing, but understand. And I think that's, for me as an ethnographer, has always been an important methodological principle of the ASTON that I think is very important, is that regardless what you're going to study, you need to understand the setting, you know. And many people just take that for, you know, what is the name of the organization, what they produce. But understanding what is supposed to do, what is it supposed to accomplish, how it is organizing for departments, how is that overall goal broken down in pieces, you have to first understand that to then understand your specific question. And the other way around, if you just work off the databases in which you don't even know what the organizations are, it takes a kind of analytical sensitivity and capacity to start to break things down. And I imagine, you know, I never did this kind of research, but, you know, by industry, by the kind of regulations that exist for that things, what you're trying to produce. So it's this step I think that sometimes misses. I had one reflection that maybe also Greta has something to say, since you study platforms. And you were hitting at that before, is that how thinking about dimensions can be useful. Because when I hear stuff about Uber, for example, which is a very much debated, you know, example of, you know, how come there are no... The idea we have about organizations have to change because we have Uber. But if you think about that in terms of the formal organizing, of the dimensions of formal organizing, there is a lot of control for structuration of the activities at Uber. Again, these people might not be full-time employees. There's the whole debate because Uber wants people to believe, you know, he wants to say that they are not really employees and blah, blah, blah. But the way in which they are controlled, the way in which they're supposed to, you know, they work, their tasks are monitored. You know, we discussed this in the podcast, is Taylorism in steroids. You know, so the dimensions are, the building blocks, the legal are still important for that.
Kind of what it makes me think is, you know, like in one of the papers, you really make the point, Bob, about viewing organizations as socio-technical systems. And I think this is where you're, what you're hinting at, Pedro, is, you know, even though these Uber drivers might not be seen as organizational members, they're still very much part of the socio-technical system, where, you know, value is created and work is happening. And increasingly what you see here is, you know, where, I mean, it kind of touches upon the automation debate, where, you know, much more and more things are being automated, and, you know, your manager might not always be a human being, it might also be part an algorithm or technology that keeps track of what you do. And that was also, like, when I was reading the papers, my reflection on how can we use these frameworks that have been so foundational in establishing our field, and how we can keep building on them and bringing them back in our analysis of how automation is impacting work and organizing.
Yeah, so a quick reflection on that. I always think back in the, you know, classic form organization, Blau and Scott book, and this whole idea. I mean, I don't know if the first ones to say that, people have said before, but personal and impersonal mechanisms of control, you know, the assembly line was already an impersonal mechanism of control. Of course, it was not automized, it was not an algorithm, blah, blah, blah. But it's like we have tools and ideas and vocabularies to think about this current phenomena that we can bring to bear, that can illuminate certain aspects of what is happening. You know. But I think there is, again, the same way that I think I was saying before, when you go to the field, there's this analytical sensitivity you need to bring. It's the same thing. You need to understand the scholarship in order to make the link and see how is it different and what the concepts apply and why they don't apply, you know. I sometimes I feel that this effort is maybe because it's not value, I don't know.
Bob, if you want to have you know, you get the last word, anything you wish to say in conclusion.
Well, I can say that I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I suppose I hope it doesn't come across as here's a guy with his feet in concrete from 60 years ago, because I don't think it's like that. But I do think that something that we've said that has been almost central to what we've said is that we really need to regain a real focus on the organization as an entity and to think comparatively, even when we're doing single case studies. We need, for example, to think, okay, if I go on to do my next case study, how can I relate it to what I've done, rather than saying, well, now let's go and do something new.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. You may not know this, but we really love receiving feedback from our listeners. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some of the best people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Karamustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Pix Kraft, Timothy Paul, Willy Lechton Virta, and Gabriel Van Bonen. And I apologize if I mispronounced your name. You are still the best and we love you so much. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website where a donations button will greet you. You can't miss it. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time for part 2 of the episode here on Talking About Organizations.